The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 2, continued.
Cassette 5, Side 2.
We would omit from view one of the characteristic ups and downs of the Russian capital punishment story if we neglected to mention that capital punishment was abolished in January 1920. Yes, indeed. And some students of the subject might conceivably be at a loss to interpret the credulity and helplessness of a dictatorship that deprived itself of its avenging sword when Denikin was still in the Kuban, Wrangel still in the Crimea, and the Polish cavalry were saddling up for a campaign. But in the first place, this decree was quite sensible. It did not extend to the decisions of military tribunals, but applied only to extrajudicial actions of the Cheka and the decisions of tribunals in the rear. In the second place, the way was prepared for it by first cleaning out the prisons by the wholesale execution of prisoners who otherwise might have come under the decree. And in the third place, it was in effect for a brief period, 4 months. It lasted only until the prisons had filled up again. By a decree of May the 28th, 1920, capital punishment was restored to the Cheka. The revolution had hastened to rename everything so that everything would seem new. Thus, the death penalty was rechristened the supreme measure, no longer a punishment but a means of social defense. From the groundwork of the criminal legislation of 1924, it is clear that the supreme measure was introduced only temporarily, pending its total abolition by the All-Russian Central Executive Committee. And in 1927, they actually did begin to abolish it. It was retained solely for crimes against the state and the army, Article 58, and military crimes, and true for banditry also. But the broad political interpretation of banditry was as well known then as it is now, from a Central Asian basmach right up to a Lithuanian forest guerrilla. Every armed nationalist who doesn't agree with the central government is a bandit, and how could one possibly get along without that article? Similarly, any participant in a camp rebellion and any participant in an urban rebellion is also a bandit. But where articles protecting private individuals were concerned, capital punishment was abolished to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the revolution. And for the 15th anniversary, the law of 7/8 was added to the roster of capital punishment, that law so vitally important to advancing socialism, which guaranteed the Soviet subject a bullet for each crumb stolen from the state's table. As always happens at the start, they hurried to apply this law in 1932 to 1933 and shot people with special ferocity. In this time of peace, in December 1932, while Kirov was still alive, at one time, 265 condemned prisoners were awaiting execution in Leningrad's Kresty prison alone. Testimony of B, who brought food to the cells of the prisoners condemned to be shot. And during the whole year, it would certainly seem that more than 1,000 were shot in Kresty alone. And what kind of evildoers were these condemned men? Where did so many plotters and troublemakers come from? Among them, for example, were 6 collective farmers from nearby Tsarskoye Selo, who were guilty of the following crime. After they had finished mowing the collective farm with their own hands, they had gone back and mowed a second time along the hummocks to get a little hay for their own cows. The All-Russian Central Executive Committee refused to pardon all 6 of these peasants, and the sentence of execution was carried out. What cruel and evil Saltychika, what utterly repulsive and infamous serf owner would have killed 6 peasants for their miserable little clippings of hay? If one had dared to beat them with birch switches even once, we would know about it and read about it in school and curse that name. What isn't known in our schools is the fact that Saltychika, by a verdict of her own peers, was imprisoned for 11 years in the subterranean crypt of the Ivanovsky Monastery in Moscow for the atrocities inflicted on her serfs. But now, heave the corpses into the water, and pretty soon the surface is all smooth again, and no one's the wiser. and one must cherish the hope that some day documents will confirm the report of my witness, who is still alive. Even if Stalin had killed no others, I believe he deserved to be drawn and quartered just for the lives of those 6 Tsarskoye Selo peasants. And yet they still dare shriek at us, from Peking, from Tirana, from Tbilisi, yes, and plenty of big bellies in the Moscow suburbs are doing it too. How could you dare expose him? How could you dare disturb his great shade? Stalin belongs to the world communist movement. But in my opinion, all he belongs to is the criminal code. The peoples of all the world remember him as a friend, but not those on whose backs he rode, whom he slashed with his knout. However, let us return to being dispassionate and impartial once more. Of course, the All-Russian Central Executive Committee would certainly have completely abolished the supreme measure, as promised. But unfortunately what happened was that in 1936 the father and teacher completely abolished the All-Russian Central Executive Committee itself. And the Supreme Soviet that succeeded it had an 18th century ring. The supreme measure became a punishment once again, and ceased to be some kind of incomprehensible social defense. Even to the Stalinist ear, the executions of 1937 to 1938 could hardly fit into any framework of defense. What legal expert, what criminal historian, will provide us with verified statistics for those 1937 to 1938 executions? Where is that special archive we might be able to penetrate in order to read the figures? There is none. There is none, and there never will be any. Therefore, we dare report only those figures mentioned in rumours that were quite fresh in 1939 to 1940, when they were drifting around under the Butyrki arches, having emanated from the high and middle-ranking Yezhov men of the NKVD, who had been arrested and had passed through those cells not long before. And they rarely knew. The Yezhov men said that during those 2 years of 1937 and 1938, 500,000 political prisoners had been shot throughout the Soviet Union, and 480,000 blatnye, habitual thieves, in addition. The thieves were all shot under Article 59.3 because they constituted a basis of Yagoda's power, and thereby the ancient and noble companionship of thieves was pruned back. How improbable are these figures, taking into consideration that the mass executions went on not for 2 full years, but only for 1.5 years, we would have to assume, under Article 58, in other words, the politicals alone, an average of 28,000 executions per month in that period, for the whole Soviet Union. But at how many different locations were executions being carried out? A figure of 150 would be very modest. There were more, of course. In Pskov alone, the NKVD set up torture and execution chambers in the basements of many churches, in former hermits' cells. And even in 1953, tourists were still not allowed into these churches on the grounds that archives were kept there. The cobwebs hadn't been swept out for 10 years at a stretch. Those were the archives they kept there. And before beginning restoration work on these churches, they had to haul away the bones in them by the truckload. On the basis of this calculation, an average of 6 people were shot in the course of 1 day at each execution site. What's so fantastic about that? It is even an understatement. According to other sources, 1,700,000 had been shot by January the 1st, 1939. During the years of World War II, the use of capital punishment was occasionally extended for various reasons, as, for example, by the militarization of the railroads, and at times was broadened as to method, from April 1943 on, for example, with a decree on hanging. All these events delayed to a certain extent the promised full, final, and perpetual repeal of the death penalty. However, the patience and loyalty of our people finally earned them this reward. In May 1947, Yosif Vissarionovich inspected his new starched dicky in his mirror, liked it, and dictated to the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet the decree on the abolition of capital punishment in peacetime. replacing it with a new maximum term of 25 years. It was a good pretext for introducing the so-called quota. But our people are ungrateful, criminal, and incapable of appreciating generosity. Therefore, after the rulers had creaked along and eked out 2.5 years without the death penalty, on January the 12th, 1950, a new decree was published that constituted an about-face. In view of petitions pouring in from the national republics, the Ukraine, from the trade unions, oh, those lovely trade unions, they always know what's needed, from peasant organizations, this was dictated by a sleepwalker. The gracious sovereign had stomped to death all peasant organizations way back in the year of the great turning point. And also from cultural leaders. Now that is quite likely. Capital punishment was restored for a conglomeration of traitors of the motherland, spies and subversives, diversionists. And of course they forgot to repeal the quota, the 25-year sentence, which remained in force. And once this return to our familiar friend, to our beheading blade, had begun, things went further with no effort at all. In 1954, for premeditated murder. In May 1961, for theft of state property and counterfeiting and terrorism in places of imprisonment. This was directed especially at prisoners who killed informers and terrorized the camp administration. In July 1961, for violating the rules governing foreign currency transactions. In February 1962, for threatening the lives of, shaking a fist at, policemen or communist vigilantes, the so-called Drozhiniki. Then for rape, and immediately thereafter for bribery. But all of this is simply temporary until complete abolition. And that's how it's described today, too. And so it turns out that Russia managed longest of all without capital punishment in the reign of the Empress Elizabeth Petrovna. In our happy, blind existence, we picture condemned men as a few ill-fated, solitary individuals. We instinctively believe that we could never end up on death row, that it would take an outstanding career, if not heinous guilt, for that to happen. A great deal is still to be shaken up inside our heads for us to get the real picture. A mass of the most ordinary, average, grey people have languished in death cells for the most ordinary, everyday misdemeanors. And although some were lucky and had their death sentences commuted, which was purely a matter of chance, they very often got the super, which is what the prisoners called the supreme measure. Since they hate lofty words and manage somehow to give everything a nickname that is both crude and short. The agronomist of a district agricultural department got a death sentence for his mistaken analysis of collective farm grain. Maybe it was because his analysis wasn't what his chiefs wanted from him. That was in 1937. Melnikov, the chairman of a handicraft artel that made spools for thread, was sentenced to death because a spark from a steam engine in his artel had caused a fire. That was in 1937. True, his death sentence was commuted to a tenner. In that same Kresty prison in Leningrad in 1932, two of the men in death cells were Feldman, convicted of possessing foreign currency, and Vitelevich, a student at the conservatory, for having sold steel ribbon for pen points. Primordial commerce, the bread and butter and pastime of the Jew, had also become worthy of the death penalty. Ought we to be surprised, then, that the Ivanovo province village lad Geraska got the death penalty? In honor of the spring St. Nicholas holiday, he went off to the next village to celebrate. He drank heavily, and with a stick he hit the rear end, no, not of the policeman himself, but of the policeman's horse. True, in a rage at the police, he ripped a piece of board off the village Soviet building and then yanked out the village Soviet telephone by the cord, shouting, "Smash the devils!" Whether our destiny holds a death cell in store for us is not determined by what we have done or not done. It is determined by the turn of a great wheel and the thrust of powerful external circumstances. For example, Leningrad was under siege and blockade. And what would its highest-ranking leader, Comrade Zhdanov, think if there were no executions among the cases in Leningrad State Security during such difficult times. He would think the organs were lying down on the job, would he not? Were there not big underground plots directed from outside by the Germans to be discovered? Why were such plots discovered under Stalin in 1919 and not under Zhdanov in 1942? No sooner ordered than done. Several ramified plots were discovered. You were asleep in your unheated Leningrad room, and the sharp claws of the Black Hand were already hovering over you. And yet, none of this depended on you. Notice was taken of a Lieutenant General Ignatovsky, whose windows looked out on the Neva. He had pulled out a white handkerchief to blow his nose. Aha! A signal! Furthermore, because Ignatovsky was an engineer, he liked to talk about machinery with the sailors. And that clinched it. Ignatovsky was arrested. The time for reckoning came. Come on now, name 40 members of your organization. He named them. And so, if you happen to be an usher at the Alexandrinsky Theater, your chances of being named as one of his particular 40 were minimal. But if you were a professor at the Technological Institute, there you were on that list. Once more, that accursed intelligentsia. So how could it depend on you? To be on such a list amounted to execution for each one. And so they shot all of them. But here is how Konstantin Ivanovich Strakovich, a very important Russian scientist in hydrodynamics, remained alive. Some even higher bigwigs in state security were dissatisfied because the list was too small and not enough people were being shot. Therefore, Strakovich was selected as a suitable center for uncovering a new organization. He was summoned by Captain Altschuler. What's this all about? Did you rush to confess everything so that you'd get shot and thereby conceal the underground government? What was your role in it? Thus, Strakovich found himself in a new round of interrogations while he remained on death row. He proposed that they consider him the underground minister of education. He wanted to get it over with as soon as possible. But that wasn't good enough for Altschuler. The interrogation continued, and by this time Ignatovsky's group was being executed. During one of the interrogation sessions, Strakovich got angry. It wasn't that he wanted to live, but that he was tired of dying, and more than anything else, the lies made him sick. And so, while he was being cross-questioned in the presence of some security police bigwig, he pounded on the table, "You are the ones who ought to be shot. I am not going to lie any longer. I take back all my testimony." And his outburst helped. Not only did they stop interrogating him, but they forgot about him in his death cell for a long time. In all probability, an outburst of desperation in the midst of general submissiveness will always help. Thus, many were shot. Thousands at first, then hundreds of thousands. We divide, we multiply, we sigh, we curse. But still and all, these are just numbers. They overwhelm the mind and then are easily forgotten. And if some day the relatives of those who had been shot were to send one publisher photographs of their executed kin, and an album of those photographs were to be published in several volumes, then just by leafing through them and looking into the extinguished eyes, we would learn much that would be valuable for the rest of our lives. Such reading, almost without words, would leave a deep mark on our hearts for all eternity. In one household I am familiar with, where some former Zeks live, the following ceremony takes place. On March the 5th, the day of the death of the head murderer, they spread out on the table all the photographs of those who were shot and those who died in camps that they have been able to collect, several dozens of them. And throughout the day, solemnity reigns in the apartment, somewhat like that of a church, somewhat like that of a museum. There is funeral music. Friends come to visit, to look at the photographs, to keep silent, to listen, to talk softly together. And then they leave without saying goodbye. And that is how it ought to be everywhere. At least these deaths would have left a small scar on our hearts, so that they should not have died in vain. And I, too, have a few such chance photographs. Look at these, at least. Viktor Petrovich Pokrovsky, shot in Moscow in 1918. Alexander Strohbinder, a student, shot in Petrograd in 1918. Vasily Ivanovich Anichkov, shot in the Lubyanka in 1927. Alexander Andreevich Svechin, a professor of the General Staff, shot in 1935. Mikhail Alexandrovich Reformatsky, an agronomist, shot in Orel in 1938. Yelizaveta Yevgenyevna Anichkova, shot in a camp on the Yenisei in 1942. How does all that happen? What is it like for people to wait there? What do they feel? What do they think about? And what decisions do they come to? And what is it like when they are taken away? And what do they feel in their last moments? And how actually do they... Well, do they... The morbid desire to pierce that curtain is natural, even though it is, of course, never going to happen to any of us. And it is natural that those who have survived cannot tell us about the very end, because, after all, they were pardoned. What happens next is something the executioners know about, but the executioners are not about to talk. Take, for instance, that famous Uncle Lyosha in the Kresty prison in Leningrad, who twisted the prisoner's hands behind his back and put handcuffs on him, and then, if the prisoner shouted down the night-time corridor, "Farewell, brothers!" crammed a rolled-up rag into his mouth. Just why should he tell you about it? He is probably still walking around Leningrad, well-dressed. But if you happen to run into him in a beer parlor on the islands or at a soccer game, ask him. However, even the executioner doesn't know about everything right to the very end. While a motor roars its accompaniment, he fires pistol bullets unheard into the back of a head, and he is himself stupidly condemned not to understand what he has done. He doesn't know about the very end. Only those who have been killed know it all to the very end, and that means no one. It's true, however, that the artist, however obliquely and unclearly, nevertheless knows some part of what happens right up to the actual bullet, the actual noose. So we are going to construct, from artists and from those who were pardoned, an approximate picture of the death cell. We know, for example, that they do not sleep at night, but lie there waiting, that they calm down again only in the morning. Narokov, Marchenko, in his novel Imaginary Values, a work much spoiled by the author's self-assigned task of describing everything as though he were Dostoevsky, of tearing at the reader's heartstrings and trying to move him even more than Dostoevsky, nevertheless, in my opinion, described the death cell and the scene of the execution itself very well. One cannot verify it, of course, but somehow one believes it. The interpretations of earlier artists, for example Leonid Andreev, seem today somehow to belong willy-nilly to Krylov's time a century and a half ago, and for that matter, what fantasist could have imagined the death cells of 1937? Of necessity, he would have woven his psychological threads, what it was like to wait, how the condemned man kept listening, and the like. But who could have foreseen and described such unexpected sensations on the part of prisoners condemned to death as 1. Prisoners awaiting execution suffered from the cold. They had to sleep on the cement floor under the windows, where it was 28 degrees Fahrenheit. Strakovich. You could freeze to death while you were waiting to be shot. 2. They suffered from being in stuffy, overcrowded cells. Into a cell intended for solitary confinement, they would shove 7, never fewer, sometimes 10, 15, even 28 prisoners awaiting execution. Strakovich in Leningrad, 1942. And they remained packed in this way for weeks or even months. What kind of nightmare was your 7 to be hanged? People in these circumstances don't think about execution, and it's not being shot they worry about, but how to move their legs, how to turn over, how to get a gulp of air. In 1937, when up to 40,000 prisoners were being held at one time in the prisons of Ivanovo, the internal prison of the NKVD, number 1, number 2, and the cells for preliminary detention, although they were just barely designed to hold 3,000 to 4,000, prison number 2 held a mixture of prisoners under interrogation, prisoners condemned to camp, prisoners sentenced to be executed, prisoners whose death sentences had been commuted, and ordinary thieves, and all of them stood for several days so jammed in against each other in one big cell that it was impossible either to raise or lower an arm, and those who were shoved up against the bunks could easily break their legs on the edges. It was winter, but in order not to be suffocated, the prisoners broke the glass in the windows. It was in this cell that the old Bolshevik Alalyakin, with his snow-white head of hair, he had joined the party in 1898, and had quit the party in 1917 after the April theses. waited for his death sentence to be carried out. 3. Prisoners sentenced to death also suffered from hunger. They waited such a long time after the death sentence had been imposed that their principal sensation was no longer the fear of being shot, but the pangs of hunger. Where could they get something to eat? In 1941, Alexander Babich spent 75 days in a death cell in the Krasnoyarsk prison. He had already reconciled himself to death and awaited execution as the only possible end to his unsuccessful life. But he began to swell up from starvation. At that point, they commuted his death sentence to 10 years, and that was when he began his camp career. And what was the record stay in a death cell? Who knows? Vsevolod Petrovich Golitsyn, the elder of a death cell, so to speak, spent 140 days in it in 1938. But was that a record? The glory of Russian science, famed geneticist N.I. Vavilov, waited several months for his execution, yes, maybe even a whole year. As a prisoner still under death sentence, he was evacuated to the Saratov prison, where he was kept in a basement cell that had no window. When his death sentence was commuted in the summer of 1942, he was transferred to a general cell, and he could not even walk. Other prisoners carried him to the daily outdoor walk, supporting him under the arms. 4. Prisoners sentenced to death were given no medical attention. Okrimenko was kept in a death cell for a long time in 1938, and he became very ill. Not only did they refuse to put him in the hospital, but the doctor took forever to come to see him. When she finally did come, she didn't go into the cell. Instead, without examining him or even asking him any questions, she handed him some powders through the bars, and fluid began to accumulate in Strakovich's legs, dropsy. He told the jailer about it, and they sent him, believe it or not, a dentist. And when a doctor did enter the picture, was it right for him to cure the prisoner under sentence of death? In other words, to prolong his expectation of death? Or did humanitarianism dictate that the doctor should insist on execution as quickly as possible? Here is another little scene from Strakovich. The doctor entered, and talking with the duty jailer, he pointed a finger at the prisoners awaiting execution. "He's a dead man! He's a dead man! He's a dead man!" He was pointing out to the jailer the victims of malnutrition and insisting that it was wrong to torment people so, that it was time to shoot them. What, in fact, was the reason for holding them so long? Weren't there enough executioners? One must point out that the prison authorities often suggested to and even asked many of the condemned prisoners to sign appeals for commutation. And when prisoners objected strongly and refused, not wanting any more deals, they signed appeals in the prisoners' names. And at the very least it took months for the papers to move through the twists and turns of the machine. A clash between two different institutions was probably involved. The interrogatory and judicial apparatus, as we learn from the members of the military collegium, they were one and the same, anxious to expose nightmarish and appalling cases, could not impose anything less than a deserved penalty on the criminals, death. But as soon as the sentences had been pronounced and entered into the official record of interrogation and trial, the scarecrows, now called condemned men, no longer interested them. And, in actual fact, there hadn't been any sedition involved, nor would the life of the state be affected in any way if these condemned men remained alive. So they were left entirely to the prison administration, and that administration, which was closely associated with Gulag, looked at prisoners from the economic point of view. To them, the important figures were not an increase in the number of executions, but an increase in the manpower sent out to the archipelago. And that is exactly the light in which Sokolov, the chief of the internal prison of the big house in Leningrad, viewed Strakovich, who finally became bored in the death cell and asked for paper and pencil for his scientific work. In a notebook, he first composed, "On the Interaction of a Liquid and a Solid Moving in It," and then "Calculations for Ballistas, Springs, and Shock Absorbers," and then "Basis of the Theory of Stability." They had already allotted him an individual scientific cell and fed him better, and questions began to come to him from the Leningrad front. He worked out for them volumetric weapons fire against aircraft, and it all ended with Zhdanov's commuting his death sentence to 15 years. The mail from the mainland was slow, but soon his regular commutation order came from Moscow, and it was more generous than Zhdanov's, merely a tenner. Strakovich has all his prison notebooks even now, and his scientific career outside the bars only began with them. He was destined later on to head up one of the first projects in the USSR for a turbojet engine. And N.P., a mathematician with the rank of assistant professor, was exploited by the interrogator Kushkov. Yes, yes, that same thief, for his personal ends. Kushkov was taking correspondent courses, and so he summoned P. from the death cell and gave him problems to solve in the theory of functions of a complex variable for Kushkov's assignments. And probably they weren't even his either. So what did world literature understand about pre-execution suffering? Finally, we learn from a story of C.H. Blank V. that a death cell can be used as an element in interrogation, as a method of coercing a prisoner. Two prisoners in Krasnoyarsk who had refused to confess were suddenly summoned to a trial, sentenced to the death penalty, and taken to the death cell. C.H. Blank V. said they were subjected to a staged trial, but in a context in which every trial is staged, what word can we use to distinguish this sort of pseudo-trial from the rest? A stage on a stage, or a play within a play, perhaps? They let them get a good swallow of that death-like life, and then they put in stoolies, who were allegedly sentenced to die also, and who suddenly began to repent, having been so stubborn during interrogation, and begged the jailer to tell the interrogator that they were now ready to sign everything. They were given their confessions to sign, and then taken out of the cell during the day. In other words, not to be shot. And what about the genuine prisoners in that cell, who had served as the raw material for the interrogator's game? They no doubt experienced reactions of their own when people in there repented and were pardoned. Well, of course, but those are the producers' costs, so to speak. They say that Konstantin Rokossovsky, the future marshal, was twice taken into the forest at night for a supposed execution. The firing squad leveled its rifles at him, and then they dropped them, and he was taken back to prison. And this was also making use of the supreme measure as an interrogator's trick. But it was all right. Nothing happened. And he is alive and healthy, and doesn't even cherish a grudge about it. And almost always a person obediently allows himself to be killed. Why is it that the death penalty has such a hypnotic effect? Those pardons recall hardly anyone in their cell who offered any resistance. But there were such cases. In the Leningrad Kresty prison in 1932, the prisoners sentenced to execution took the jailer's revolvers away and opened fire. Following this, a different approach was adopted. After peering through the peephole to locate the person they wanted to take, they swarmed into the cell, five armed jailers at a time, and rushed to grab their man. There were eight prisoners under sentence of death in the cell, but every one of them, after all, had sent a petition to Kalinin, and everyone expected a commutation, and therefore, you today, me tomorrow. They moved away and looked on indifferently while the condemned man was tied up, while he cried out for help, while they shoved a child's rubber ball into his mouth. Now, looking at that child's ball, could one really guess all its possible uses? What a good example for a lecturer on the dialectical method. Does hope lend strength, or does it weaken a man? If the condemned men in every cell had ganged up on the executioners as they came in and choked them, wouldn't this have ended the execution sooner than appeals to the All-Russian Central Executive Committee? When one is already on the edge of the grave, why not resist? But wasn't everything foredoomed anyway from the moment of arrest? Yet all the arrested crawled along the path of hope on their knees, as if their legs had been amputated. Vasily Grigorievich Vlasov remembers that night after he'd been sentenced when he was being taken through dark Kadi, and four pistols were brandished on four sides of him. His main thought was, "What if they shoot right now as a provocation, claiming I was trying to escape?" Obviously he didn't yet believe in his sentence. He still hoped to live. They confined him in the police room. He was allowed to lie down on the desk to sleep, and two or three policemen kept continuous guard by the light of a kerosene lamp. They talked among themselves. I kept listening and listening for 4 days, and I never could understand what they were being condemned for. It's not for us to understand. Vlasov lived in this room for 5 days. They were waiting for an official confirmation of the verdict in order to execute them right there in Kadi. It was not easy to convoy the condemned men to some other point. Someone sent a telegram for Vlasov requesting pardon. I do not admit my guilt, and I request that my life be spared. There was no reply. During these days, Vlasov's hand shook so that he could not lift his spoon to his mouth, and instead picked up his bowl and drank directly from it. Klyugin visited him to jeer. Soon after the Kadi case, he was transferred from Ivanovo to Moscow. That year saw swift ascendances and swift declines among those crimson stars of the Gulag heaven. The time was approaching when they, too, would be hurled into that same pit, but they didn't know it. Neither confirmation nor commutation of the sentence arrived, so they had to take the 4 condemned men to Kineshma. They took them in 4 1.5-ton trucks, with 1 condemned man guarded by 7 policemen in each truck. In Kineshma, they were put in the crypt of a monastery. Monastery architecture, liberated from monkish ideology, was very useful for us. At this point, some other condemned prisoners were added to their group, and they were all taken in a prisoner's railroad car to Ivanovo. In the freight yard in Ivanovo, they separated 3 from the rest, Saburov, Vlasov, and 1 of the men from the other group, and immediately took the others away to be shot, so as not to crowd the prison any further. And thus it was that Vlasov said farewell to Smirnov. The 3 others were put in the courtyard of prison number 1 in the dank and raw October air, and held there for 4 hours while they led out, led in, and searched other groups of prisoners in transit. There was still no actual proof that they wouldn't be shot that very day. During those 4 hours, they had to sit there on the ground and think about it. At one point, Saburov thought they were being taken to be shot, but they were actually taken to a cell instead. He did not cry out, but he gripped his neighbor's arm so hard that the latter yelled with pain. The guards had to drag Saburov and prod him with their bayonets. There were 4 death cells in this prison, in the same corridor as the juvenile cells and the hospital cells. The death cells had 2 doors, the customary wooden door with a peephole, and a door made of iron grating. Each door had 2 locks, and the jailer and the block supervisor each had a key to a different one, so the doors could be opened only by the 2 together. Cell 43 was on the other side of a wall of the interrogator's office, and at night, while the condemned men were waiting to be executed, their ears were tormented by the screams of prisoners being tortured. Vlasov was put into cell 61. This was a cell intended for solitary confinement, 16 feet long and a little more than 3 feet wide. 2 iron cots were anchored to the floor by thick iron bolts, and on each cot, 2 condemned men were lying, their heads at opposite ends. 14 other prisoners were lying crosswise on the cement floor. Though it has long been well known that even a corpse has a right to 3 arshins of earth, and even that seemed too little to Chekhov, in this cell, each of the condemned had been allotted, while waiting for death, a little less than a third of that. Vlasov asked whether executions were carried out immediately. See for yourself. We've been here for ages, and we're still alive. The time of waiting began, of the well-known kind. The prisoners didn't sleep all night long. In a state of total depression, they waited to be led out to death. They listened for every rustling in the corridor. And the worst thing was that endless waiting destroys the will to resist. Particularly nerve-wracking were the nights following a day on which someone received a commutation of sentence. He went off with cries of happiness, and fear thickened in the cell. After all, rejections as well as commutation had rolled down from the high mountain that day, and at night they would come for someone. Sometimes the locks rattled at night and hearts fell. Is it for me? Not me. And the turnkey would open the wooden door for some nonsense or other. Take your things off the windowsill. That unlocking of the door probably took a year off the lives of all 19 inmates. Maybe if that door was unlocked a mere 50 times, they wouldn't have to waste bullets. But how grateful to him everyone was, because everything was all right. We'll take them off right away, Citizen Chief. After the morning visit to the toilet, they went to sleep, liberated from their fears. Then the jailer brought in the pail of gruel and said, "Good morning." According to prison rules, the inner iron door was supposed to be opened only in the presence of the duty officer for the prison. But as is well known, human beings are better and lazier than their rules and instructions, and in the morning the jailer came in without the duty officer and greeted them quite humanly. No, it was even more precious than that. "Good morning." To whom else on all the earth was that morning as good as it was to them? Grateful for the warmth of that voice and the warmth of that dishwater, they drifted off to sleep until noon. They ate only in the morning. Many were unable to eat when they awoke during the day. Someone had received a parcel. Relatives might or might not know about the death sentence. Once in the cell, these parcels became common property, but they lay and rotted there in the stagnant damp. By day, there was still a little life and activity in the cell. The block supervisor might come around, either gloomy Tarakanov or friendly Makarov, and offer paper on which to write petitions, and ask whether any of them who had some money wanted to buy smokes from the commissary. Their questions seemed either too outrageous or extraordinarily human. The pretense was being made that they weren't condemned men at all. Was that it? The condemned men broke off the bottoms of matchboxes, marked them like dominoes, and played away. Vlasov eased his tension by telling someone about the consumer cooperatives, and his narrative always took on a comic touch. His stories about the consumer cooperatives are remarkable and deserve to be published. Yakov Petrovich Kolpakov, the chairman of the Sudogda District Executive Committee, a Bolshevik since the spring of 1917 who joined up at the front, sat for dozens of days without changing his position, squeezing his head in his hands, his elbows on his knees, always staring at the same spot on the wall. It must have been so jolly to recall the spring of 1917. Vlasov's garrulity irritated him. "How can you?" And Vlasov snapped back at him. "And what are you doing? Preparing yourself for heaven?" Vlasov spoke with round O's, even in a fast retort. "For myself, I've decided one thing only. I'm going to tell the executioner, you alone, not the judges, not the prosecutors, you alone are guilty of my death, and you are going to have to live with it. If it weren't for you willing executioners, there would be no death sentences. So, then, let him kill me, the rat." Kolpakov was shot. Konstantin Sergeyevich Arkadyev, the former manager of the Alexandrov District Agricultural Department in Vladimir Province, was shot. Somehow, in his case, the farewells were particularly hard. During the night, 6 guards came tramping in for him, making a big rush of it, while he, gentle, well-mannered, kept turning around, twisting his cap in his hands, putting off the moment of his leave-taking from the last people on earth for him. And when he said his final farewell, you could hardly hear his voice. At the very first moment, when the victim has been pointed out, the rest are relieved. "It's not me." But right after he has been taken away, the ones left behind are in a state that is hardly any easier to bear than his. All the next day, those left behind are destined to silence, and they won't want to eat. However, Geraska, the young fellow who broke up the building of the village Soviet, ate well and slept a lot, getting used to things even here with typical peasant facility. He somehow couldn't believe they would shoot him, and they didn't. They commuted his sentence to a tenner. Several of the inmates turned grey in 3 or 4 days before their cellmates' eyes. When people wait so long for executions, their hair grows, and orders are given for the whole cell to get haircuts, for the whole cell to get baths. Prison existence goes on without regard to sentences. Some individuals lost the ability to speak intelligibly and to understand, but they were left there to await their fate anyway. Anyone who went insane in the death cell was executed insane. Many sentences were commuted. It was right then, in that fall of 1937, that 15- and 20-year terms were introduced for the first time since the revolution, and in many cases they replaced the executioner's bullets.
This book is continued on Cassette 6, Side 1.